Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the cutting-edge research that's shaping our understanding of the world. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we're excited to discuss a fascinating paper that explores the data-generating process behind some of the most widely used factors in time series asset pricing. The paper is titled Data Generating Process and Time Series Asset Pricing and is authored by Xuxin Guo and Qian Lu.
This paper tackles a critical issue that the vast majority of asset pricing research seems to have overlooked: the data-generating processes underlying the factors used to explain equity excess returns. As the authors point out, a clear understanding of these data-generating processes is crucial for avoiding model misspecifications and providing a firm foundation for explaining excess returns.
That's right, Tom. The authors dive deep into the distinctions between two common categories of value processes, buy and hold and periodic rebalancing. These different data-generating processes have significant implications for how we should analyze and interpret the factors used in asset pricing models.
Exactly. Let's start by looking at the buy and hold process. This is the value of a portfolio or the price of a stock over time, which can be modeled as a geometric Brownian motion. The simplest continuous time stochastic process widely used in finance. In contrast, the periodic rebalancing process is a bit more complex, as it involves starting each period with the same amount of capital, but the authors note that it's difficult to associate this process with a known stochastic model.
The key difference between these two processes is the compounding effect. With a buy and hold strategy, the gains or losses in each period are not realized until the portfolio is liquidated. This allows the compounding effect to take hold, which is a crucial driver of long-term investment performance. In contrast, the periodic rebalancing strategy involves realizing the gains and losses in each period, effectively ignoring the compounding effect.
Absolutely, Jen. The authors argue that the compounding effect is of utmost importance and should not be overlooked in empirical time series asset pricing. They even cite Nobel laureate Myron Scholes, who emphasized that compound returns were very different to the average returns, or Sharpe ratios, that investors measure, and urged investors to be patient and harvest the power of compound returns.
That's a powerful endorsement from such a renowned figure in finance. The authors then turn their attention to the long-short portfolios that are so ubiquitous in asset pricing research. They make the case that the definition of returns for these zero-cost portfolios is fundamentally problematic, as the initial value of the portfolio is zero, making a meaningful definition of returns impossible.
Exactly, Jen. The authors also find that the market factor, which is commonly defined as the excess return of the market portfolio, significantly underestimates the compounding effect of the difference between the market portfolio and the risk-free rate when treated as a buy-and-hold long-short portfolio.
This is a really important insight, Tom. The authors argue that the correct way to model the market factor is using non-excess log returns, as this captures the compounding effect inherent in the buy-and-hold nature of the market portfolio. Treating the market factor as a periodic rebalancing long-short portfolio, as is sometimes done, would be economically less relevant and suffer from what the authors call the tiny size paradox.
That's fascinating, Jen. The authors delve even deeper, looking at the implications for the Fama-French three-factor, FF3, model. If the market factor is treated as a buy-and-hold long-short portfolio, the FF3 factors would be inconsistent. But if the market factor is viewed as a periodic rebalancing portfolio, the model would become economically insignificant and irrelevant, as the size and value factors also suffer from the tiny size paradox.
Wow, that's a really important finding. The authors make a strong case that asset pricing factors would be better represented by non-excess or non-difference log returns, which capture the compounding effect that is so crucial for long-term investing. They also demonstrate through numerical analyses that using net returns in OLS regressions can lead to inflated T-values, exaggerated alphas, and overestimated Sharpe ratios.
This is a really thought-provoking study, Jen. The authors have clearly done a deep dive into the underlying data-generating processes and have uncovered some significant issues with how factors are commonly defined and used in asset pricing research. Their insights about the importance of the compounding effect and the problems with long, short, and periodic rebalancing portfolios are truly eye-opening.
I agree, Tom. This paper really challenges some of the fundamental assumptions and practices in the field of time series asset pricing. By focusing on the data-generating processes, the authors have shed light on crucial aspects that have been overlooked. Their recommendations to use non-excess log returns and to be more thoughtful about the economic relevance of the factors used are sure to have a significant impact on how researchers approach asset pricing going forward.
Absolutely. This is the kind of research that can really shift the paradigm and push the field in a more rigorous and impactful direction. The authors have done an excellent job of identifying the problems, providing a clear analytical framework, and offering constructive solutions. It's a brilliant piece of work that deserves close attention from anyone interested in asset pricing and the drivers of investment performance.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. This paper is a must-read for anyone who wants to truly understand the foundations of time series asset pricing. By delving into the data-generating processes, the authors have uncovered critical issues that could have far-reaching implications for how we model and interpret the factors used to explain excess returns. It's a fascinating study that is sure to spark important discussions and further research in this field.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jen, for joining me in this deep dive into this groundbreaking paper. Listeners, we hope you found this discussion as engaging and enlightening as we have. Be sure to check out the paper for yourself to explore these ideas in even greater depth. Until next time, keep exploring the cutting edge of research with us.
Thanks, Tom. This has been a fascinating episode, and we're grateful to the authors for their insightful contributions to the field of asset pricing. We'll see you all next time.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Compound Capital, the investment firm that's leveraging the power of compounding to revolutionize the world of asset management.
Are you tired of your investments underperforming because your fund managers don't understand the true value of compounding? Well, look no further than Compound Capital.
Compound Capital was founded by a group of renegade finance PhDs who were sick and tired of seeing investors get shortchanged by the traditional, short-sighted approach to asset pricing.
That's right, Tom. Our team of compounding crusaders has developed a cutting-edge investment strategy that harnesses the magical powers of buy and hold portfolios. Say goodbye to those pesky periodic rebalancing headaches.
With Compound Capital, your money will work harder than a data-generating machine on espresso. We'll make your returns compound faster than a Fibonacci sequence on steroids.
Don't just take our word for it. Our flagship mega compounding fund has delivered mind-bending returns that'll make your investment rivals green with envy. Join the Compound Capital revolution and let the power of compounding work for you.
Compound Capital. Where the only thing growing faster than your wealth is your awe of the mathematical beauty of exponential functions. Visit CompoundCapital.com to start compounding your way to financial freedom today.
Compounding has never been so much fun. Compound Capital, the investment firm that's turning time series asset pricing on its head, one spectacular return at a time.
Welcome to Discoveries Decoded, the podcast that investigates cutting-edge research with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. Today, we're diving into a fascinating paper that challenges the legendary returns of one of the most successful hedge funds in history.
The paper is titled "Is the Annualized Compounded Return of Medallion Over 35%? And it's authored by Shuxin Guo and Cheng Liu.
This research really caught our attention because it questions the sky-high returns that have long been reported for the Medallion Fund, which was founded and run by legendary investor Jim Simons.
That's right. Medallion is known for delivering absolutely staggering returns. Some estimates have put its annualized compounded return as high as 66% before fees. But our guests today argue that those numbers are likely incorrect.
They propose a more rigorous approach to estimating Medallion's true compounded return, and their findings suggest the returns are probably closer to 35% or less. This has huge implications for how we evaluate the performance of elite hedge funds.
So let's dive in and explore this paper in more detail. What exactly did the researchers find, and how did they arrive at their conclusions? Jin, can you walk us through the key points?
Absolutely. The main issue the authors identify is that the typical way of calculating a fund's compounded returns, by simply compounding the annual net returns, doesn't work well for funds with discontinuous asset growth, like Medallion.
That's a really important point. Most people would just look at Medallion's reported annual returns of over 60% and compound those to arrive at the overall return. But the researchers say that approach is flawed.
Exactly. They use a couple simple examples to illustrate the problem. Imagine a fund that starts with $100 and earns 50% returns 2 years in a row. Naively compounding those 50% returns would suggest a final value of $225. But the actual final value is only $200, a big difference.
I see. So the discontinuous nature of the fund's asset growth, with jumps up and down, means you can't just chain the annual returns together. There's more to it than that.
Right. The researchers propose a more rigorous approach they call size profit compounding. This takes into account the fund's starting size, its trading profits each year, any cash flows in or out, and financing costs. When they apply this methodology to Medallion, the estimated annualized compounded return comes out to 32.6% before fees.
Wow, that's a significant difference from the 66% figure that's been reported. So they're saying the true returns are probably under 35%, not the astronomical levels that have been claimed.
Exactly, and they actually suggest another approach as well, using the growth of the fund manager's personal wealth as a proxy for the fund's returns. When they do that for Jim Simons, they estimate his annualized compounded growth at 25.6% over 33 years.
That's fascinating. So even Simons' personal wealth growth, which would include the fees he's earned from running Medallion, points to returns below 35%. This really challenges the conventional wisdom about Medallion's performance.
It does. The authors argue that the initial tiny size of both the fund and Simons' personal stake is a big factor driving those very high compounded growth rates. But as the fund and Simons' wealth have grown, the returns have come down significantly.
That makes a lot of sense. The power of compounding is strongest when you start with a small base. As the base gets larger, it becomes harder to maintain those astronomical growth rates.
Exactly. The researchers conclude that Medallion's annualized compounded return is probably under 35%, still an incredible achievement, but not the 60% plus numbers that have been widely reported. Their work really highlights the importance of calculating fund performance correctly, especially for funds with complex, discontinuous growth patterns.
This is a great example of how rigorous, careful analysis can overturn widely accepted narratives. The conventional wisdom about Medallion's returns was almost certainly overstated. What do you make of the broader implications, Jen?
I think this research has huge implications for how we evaluate the performance of elite hedge funds and other alternative investment vehicles. So often, we just accept the top-line returns that are reported without really scrutinizing the methodology. But as this paper shows, that can lead to seriously flawed conclusions.
Absolutely. And it raises important questions about transparency and accountability in the hedge fund industry. If even legendary funds like Medallion are potentially misrepresenting their returns, what does that mean for the rest of the industry?
It's a great point. This work really underscores the need for more rigor, more oversight, and more transparency when it comes to reporting investment performance, especially for complex, high-stakes funds. Investors deserve accurate information to make informed decisions.
Well said. This has been a fascinating dive into a piece of research that challenges some long-held assumptions. I'm really glad we got to explore it in depth. Before we wrap up, Jen, any final thoughts you'd like to share?
Just that I'm really impressed by the careful, innovative approach the authors took in this paper. They didn't just accept the conventional wisdom, but dug deeper to try to uncover the true story behind Medallion's returns. That kind of rigorous, skeptical analysis is so important, especially in fields like finance where reputations and narratives can become entrenched.
Absolutely. This is a great reminder that even the most renowned funds and managers aren't immune to scrutiny. We have to keep asking tough questions and holding the industry accountable. Thanks for joining me today, Jen. This was a fascinating discussion.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoyed exploring this research with you. It just goes to show there's always more to discover, even about the most celebrated investment success stories.
Absolutely. For our listeners, you can find a link to the full research paper in the show notes. Until next time, keep questioning, keep exploring, and keep discoveries decoded. Are you tired of the same old, boring investment products? Looking for something truly unique and potentially life-changing? Then you need to check out Return Magic, the revolutionary new hedge fund management system inspired by the Medallion research.
With Return Magic, you can finally unlock the secret to 60% annual returns. That's right, 60% just like the legendary Medallion fund. Except our team of financial wizards has figured out a way to do it legally and without any of that pesky transparency or accountability stuff.
How do we do it? Trade secrets, baby. Lots and lots of trade secrets. Oh, and a healthy dose of creative accounting. Compound those returns, baby. Compound them good.
But wait, there's more. Sign up for Return Magic in the next 20 minutes, and we'll throw in a free set of steak knives. Because when your portfolio is growing 60% a year, you're gonna need some serious cutlery to slice through all the cash.
So what are you waiting for? Call 1-800-RETURN-MAGIC and start building your fortune today. Results not guaranteed, but hey, who needs guarantees when you've got magic?
Return Magic, where the only limit is your imagination, or your audacity, whichever.
Welcome to the Curiosity Chronicles, where we dive deep into the latest scientific research with riveting storytelling and expert analysis. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host Jen.
Hi there, listeners. We have a fascinating paper to discuss with you all today. The title is Road to Perdition: The Effect of Illicit Drug Use on Labor Market Outcomes of Prime-Age Men in Mexico.
This study, conducted by researchers from the University of Salamanca and FLACSO Ecuador, explores a critical issue that has far-reaching implications: the impact of illicit drug use on the job prospects of working-age men in Mexico.
Mexico has unfortunately become infamous as a major international hub for the trafficking and consumption of illicit substances over the past two decades. The researchers wanted to shed light on how this epidemic is affecting the livelihoods of ordinary Mexicans.
You're right, Jen. Mexico's battle against drug cartels has taken a severe economic toll, deterring growth and harming the functioning of the labor market. Yet, until now, we've lacked solid evidence on the consequences of drug use for Mexican workers.
That's what makes this study so important. The researchers leveraged data from three waves of a nationally representative survey on drug use and employment patterns to rigorously analyze the relationship between illicit substance consumption and labor market outcomes.
Exactly. They focused specifically on prime-age men between 22 and 50 years old, as this group is the most economically active. The researchers considered four key outcomes: employment, unemployment, occupational attainment, and formality of employment.
Uncovering the causal impact of drug use on these labor market indicators is a major challenge, given the potential for endogeneity. People who use illicit substances may differ from non-users in unobservable ways that also affect the job prospects.
That's right. Factors like personality traits, self-control, or health status could influence both drug consumption and economic success. There could also be reverse causality, where better-performing workers can afford to use more drugs.
To address these endogeneity concerns, the researchers employed a clever identification strategy using Lubel's instrumental variable approach. This method relies on the heteroscedasticity, or unequal variance, of the residuals to construct valid instruments when traditional external instruments are unavailable.
Fascinating. So by leveraging the statistical properties of the data itself, they were able to overcome the lack of obvious external factors to use as instruments. This is a really innovative way to tackle the thorny issue of endogeneity in this context.
Absolutely. And their results paint a concerning picture. The researchers found that drug use has quite negative effects on the labor market outcomes of prime-age Mexican men.
The IV estimates suggest that drug consumption reduces employment by 3.8 percentage points, increases the likelihood of unemployment by 4 percentage points, lowers the probability of holding a white-collar job by 6.3 percentage points, and decreases formal employment by 6.1 percentage points.
Wow, those are substantial impacts. It seems that the consequences of illicit drug use are even more severe in the Mexican context compared to what has been found in high-income countries.
Yes, the authors note that their findings appear to be more negative than the evidence from developed economies. They speculate that this could be due to factors like weaker social safety nets and limited resources for anti-drug campaigns and addiction treatment in Mexico.
That makes a lot of sense. The researchers also examined heterogeneity in the effects, finding that the impacts tend to be larger for younger men and those with lower levels of education. The harm from hard drugs also seems to be more pronounced than for softer substances.
Those nuanced findings are really interesting. It suggests that certain demographic groups may be particularly vulnerable to the labor market consequences of drug use. Policymakers would need to take these differential impacts into account when designing interventions.
Absolutely. And the robustness checks the authors conducted, including using an alternative instrumental variable based on religious affiliation, bolster confidence in the main results.
Yes, while that second IV approach has its own limitations, the fact that it points to similarly negative effects is quite reassuring. Overall, this study provides compelling evidence that the drug crisis in Mexico is not just a public safety issue, but is also deeply damaging the livelihoods of working-age men.
It's a sobering reminder of the far-reaching consequences of the country's entanglement with the illicit drug trade. These findings underscore the urgent need for comprehensive policies that not only tackle the supply side, but also address the demand for drugs and support those struggling with addiction.
Absolutely. Policymakers can't afford to ignore the economic toll of this crisis. Investing in evidence-based prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation programs could pay huge dividends in terms of improving employment prospects and overall economic well-being.
Definitely, this research really drives home the point that the drug problem in Mexico isn't just a law enforcement issue, it's a public health and economic issue that requires a multi-pronged, holistic approach. The stakes are high, both for individuals and for the country as a whole.
Well said, Jin. This study is a sobering wake-up call, but also an opportunity to enact meaningful change. By shedding light on the devastating labor market impacts of illicit drug use, it provides crucial evidence to guide more effective policies and support systems.
Absolutely. This is the kind of impactful, rigorous research that can truly make a difference in people's lives. We're grateful to the researchers for taking on this important challenge and providing such valuable insights.
Me too, Jin. This episode really drives home the urgent need to address Mexico's drug crisis from multiple angles. There's no easy solution, but studies like this one are an important step towards creating a brighter, more prosperous future for working-age Mexicans.
Well said, Tom. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into the impacts of illicit drug use. We hope you found it as compelling and thought-provoking as we did. Until next time, keep exploring.
Take care, everyone.
Are you tired of the negative impacts of drug use on your job prospects?
Introducing Sober Success, the all-new employment agency for drug-free workers in Mexico.
At Sober Success, we know that staying clean and sober is the key to a thriving career. That's why we only place top talent who have sworn off the hard stuff.
No more wasted potential. With Sober Success, you'll find your dream job, whether it's accounting, engineering, or running your own cartel-free business.
Our rigorous drug testing and background checks ensure you're hiring the most reliable, productive employees around. Because who needs buzz baristas when you can have stone-cold sober superstars?
So what are you waiting for? Call 1-800-CLEAN-ME to connect with your new drug-free dream team. Courtesy of Sober Success, putting the work back in workaholic.
Sober Success, keeping Mexico's labor force high on success, low on everything else.
Welcome to the Investigate Research Podcast. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host Jen.
Hi there, listeners. Today we're diving into a fascinating paper that takes a deep dive into the carbon emissions of battery electric vehicles, BEVs, in China. The title of the paper is Bottom-Up Approach to Assess Carbon Emissions of Battery Electric Vehicle Operations in China.
This is really exciting research, Jen. The study was conducted by Hong Yuan from the Chongqing University and Minda Ma from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and Chongqing University. They set out to develop a novel bottom-up framework for estimating the electricity use and carbon emissions of BEVs across different climate zones in China during the 2020s.
Absolutely, Tom. The transportation sector is a major contributor to global greenhouse gas emissions, so understanding the environmental impact of electric vehicles is crucial as we work towards a more sustainable future. Let's dive into the details of how the researchers tackled this challenge.
The key innovation of this study was the bottom-up approach they used. Rather than relying on top-down, national-level data, the researchers built their model from the ground up, analyzing the performance and usage of individual BEV models in different regions of China.
That's right. They started by focusing on the top 20 best-selling BEV models in China, looking at factors like vehicle performance, sales volumes, mileage, and energy intensity. Then they incorporated regional differences in climate conditions to paint a comprehensive picture of the electricity demand and carbon emissions associated with BEV operations.
Fascinating. Can you walk us through how they actually constructed this bottom-up model?
Sure, let me break it down. The researchers first calculated the annual electricity consumption for each version of the top 20 BEV models, taking into account factors like sales share, mileage, and energy efficiency. They then summed up the electricity use for all the models within each of the three major climate zones in China, North, Middle and Lower Yangtze River, and South.
Okay, I see. So they were really getting granular, looking at how things like temperature and driving conditions in different regions might impact the energy needs of these vehicles. That must have been a complex undertaking.
Definitely. To capture those regional variations, they used parameters like the New European Driving Cycle, which measures vehicle energy consumption, and applied degradation coefficients to account for the impact of temperature extremes in the summer and winter. It's an impressively detailed model that allows them to paint a very precise picture of BEV electricity use across China.
And I imagine they didn't stop there. How did they then translate that electricity consumption into carbon emissions?
Great question. The researchers took their electricity demand estimates for each climate zone and multiplied them by the corresponding regional emission factors for the power sector. This allowed them to calculate the total carbon emissions associated with the BEV operations in each region, and then sum those up to get the nationwide figure.
Wow, that's a really comprehensive approach. I'm curious to hear what their key findings were from applying this bottom-up model.
The results are quite fascinating, Tom. First, they found that the electricity demand for the top 20 best-selling BEV models in China grew rapidly, from 601 gigawatt hours, GWH, in 2020 to 3,054 gigawatt hours by 2022. And interestingly, over half of that total demand came from BEVs operating in the South China region.
That's a massive increase in just a couple of years. What about the energy and carbon intensities of these vehicles? Did they see any improvements there?
Yes, the researchers did observe some positive trends. From 2020 to 2022, the energy intensity of the top-selling models decreased from 1,364 kWh per vehicle to 1,095 kWh per vehicle. And the carbon intensity dropped from 797 kg of CO2 per vehicle to 621 kg. The North China region actually saw the biggest improvements in these intensities compared to the other climate zones.
That's really promising to hear. It suggests that as the EV market in China has grown, the vehicles themselves are becoming more efficient and lower emitting. But of course, the overall picture goes beyond just the top-selling models, right?
Exactly. The researchers also looked at the electricity demand and emissions for China's entire BEV stock, not just the bestsellers. And the numbers there are even more staggering. The total electricity consumption of the BEV fleet increased from 4,774 gigawatt-hours in 2020 to 12,048 gigawatt-hours in 2022. And the associated carbon emissions rose to 6.8 million tons of CO2 in 2022. That's an annual growth rate of over 50%.
Wow, those are some really eye-opening figures. It shows just how rapidly electrification is transforming the passenger vehicle landscape in China, with huge implications for the power grid and emissions. But I imagine the researchers had some important caveats and limitations to point out as well.
Absolutely. The authors acknowledge that their model doesn't fully capture the nuances of residential charging systems and microgrids, which could further impact the energy use and emissions from BEVs at a local level. They suggest that future studies should dig deeper into those dynamics to get an even more granular understanding.
That makes a lot of sense. Integrating that kind of hyperlocal data would be the next logical step to refine the analysis. Overall, though, this seems like a really robust and innovative framework for quantifying the environmental footprint of electric vehicles.
I completely agree, Tom. By taking this bottom-up approach and getting into the nitty-gritty details of BEV usage across China's diverse regions, the researchers have provided invaluable insights to support nationwide efforts in decarbonizing the transportation sector. It's a great example of how rigorous, data-driven research can illuminate the path towards a sustainable future.
Definitely. This is the kind of work that policymakers and industry leaders need to inform their decisions and strategies. I'm really impressed by the depth and thoroughness of this analysis. Thanks for walking us through it, Jen. I feel like I have a much richer understanding of the carbon implications of electric vehicle adoption in China now.
Absolutely, Tom. This is cutting-edge research that really gets to the heart of a crucial sustainability challenge. I'm excited to see how the insights from this paper can help accelerate the transition to cleaner transportation solutions, not just in China, but around the world. There's so much more we can uncover by diving deep into the data and dynamics behind the electrification revolution.
Well said, Jin. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm sure our listeners are as energized as we are about the potential of electric vehicles to drive us towards a more sustainable future. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Investigate Research.
Thanks, Tom. Until next time, keep exploring and stay curious.
Are you tired of the same old boring kitchen gadgets? Well, get ready for the revolutionary new climate cooler, the ultimate kitchen appliance for the environmentally conscious chef.
Powered by advanced battery technology, the climate cooler uses cutting-edge energy efficiency to keep your food perfectly chilled, no matter the weather outside.
Whether you're cooking in the scorching heat of South China or the frigid winters of North China, the climate cooler automatically adjusts to maintain the ideal temperature, saving you energy and slashing your carbon footprint.
But that's not all. The climate cooler is also equipped with a built-in carbon emissions calculator, so you can track just how eco-friendly your culinary creations are.
Impress your friends at your next dinner party with your commitment to sustainability, all while enjoying perfectly preserved ingredients.
The climate cooler, the future of green kitchens, available now for the low price of 999 yuan and 99 fen. Call 1-800-STAY-COOL to order yours today.
Climate cooler. Keeping your food fresh, and your conscience clear. Welcome to The Cutting Edge, the podcast that explores the frontiers of science and technology. I'm Tom, and alongside me is my co-host Jen. Today, we're diving into a fascinating research paper that investigates a cutting-edge approach to credit risk management in commercial banks.
That's right, Tom. The paper we'll be discussing is titled Research on Credit Risk Early Warning Model of Commercial Banks Based on Neural Network Algorithm, and it was authored by a talented team of researchers from institutions like Columbia University, the University of Electronic Science and Technology of China, and Washington University in St. Louis.
This is an important topic, Jin, as commercial banks around the world are grappling with an escalating magnitude of credit risk in the face of globalized financial markets. The researchers set out to develop a novel early warning model that can help banks preempt these risks more effectively.
Absolutely, Tom. The paper starts by examining some of the conventional approaches to financial risk management, such as ARMA models, ARCH models, and logistic regression. While these methods have their own strengths, the researchers argue that they often fall short when dealing with the highly complex and nonlinear nature of modern financial data.
That's a great point, Jen. The researchers recognize that commercial banks urgently need a more intelligent system, one that can rapidly respond to market dynamics and accurately forecast latent risks. And that's where the backpropagation, BP, neural network comes into play.
The BP neural network, as the researchers explain, is a powerful tool for pattern recognition and data forecasting. It has several key advantages when it comes to credit risk management in commercial banks. First, it's adept at uncovering and modeling intricate nonlinear relationships by learning from historical data. This is crucial, as the complex nature of financial markets often defies the linear assumptions of traditional statistical models.
Exactly, Jin. The BP neural network also demonstrates impressive self-adaptation and learning capabilities, continuously refining its model as new data becomes available. This allows the model to stay agile and responsive, keeping pace with the ever-evolving financial landscape.
Furthermore, the flexible structure of BP neural networks enables the researchers to tailor the model to specific analytical needs. They can adjust the depth of the hidden layers and the number of neurons to capture nuanced features in the data, leading to more accurate risk predictions.
That adaptability is so important, Jin. And the researchers didn't stop there. They also highlighted the BP neural network's ability to handle large datasets and its robustness in dealing with noise and outliers. These are critical features for a credit risk early warning system that needs to sift through vast amounts of financial data.
Absolutely, Tom. The paper then goes on to explain the key steps involved in designing the BP neural network model for this application. They discuss the importance of selecting the right network topology, with a focus on using a simple three-layer structure, an input layer, a hidden layer, and an output layer.
That's a really interesting point, Jin. The researchers explain that while more complex, Multi-layer networks can theoretically express even more complex functions. They can also be prone to overfitting and local minima problems. The single hidden layer approach, on the other hand, has been shown to be sufficient for approximating a wide range of functions in practical applications.
Absolutely, Tom, and the selection of the activation function is another critical component. The researchers explore the trade-offs between global activation functions, like the sigmoid function, and local activation functions, like the rectified linear unit, ReLU. Each has its own strengths and weaknesses, and the choice ultimately depends on the specific requirements of the task at hand.
That's a great explanation, Jen. The paper then delves into the overall design of the credit risk early warning system for commercial banks, which is composed of three key components: a data processing system, a data analysis system, and a decision management system.
That's right, Tom. The data processing system is responsible for gathering, refining, and formatting the data, ensuring it's clean and ready for analysis. The data analysis system then applies advanced techniques, like the BP neural network, to identify potential risk patterns and assess borrowers' default probabilities.
And the decision management system is where the rubber meets the road, Jen. This is the part that takes the analytical insights and formulates the final credit decisions, weighing factors like market conditions, regulatory policies, and the bank's own risk tolerance.
Exactly, Tom. By integrating these three components, the researchers have developed a comprehensive early warning mechanism that can enhance the precision and responsiveness of commercial banks' credit risk management.
The paper wraps up with an empirical study that validates the effectiveness of this approach. The researchers selected a diverse sample of 267 companies, including both those under special treatment and those operating normally, to test the model's performance.
That's a great point, Tom. The diversity of the sample is crucial, as it allows the researchers to evaluate the model's applicability across different types of companies and market conditions. This ensures the findings are broadly applicable and reliable, providing commercial banks with a robust theoretical and data-driven foundation.
Absolutely, Jen. This research represents a significant step forward in the field of credit risk management for commercial banks. By harnessing the power of advanced neural network techniques, the researchers have developed a highly responsive and adaptable early warning system that can help banks navigate the increasingly complex and volatile financial landscape.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. This work not only showcases the immense potential of AI and machine learning in the banking sector, but it also highlights the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration between finance, computer science, and operations research. It's a truly inspiring example of how cutting-edge research can drive real-world innovation and impact.
Well said, Jen. This paper is a prime example of the kind of groundbreaking discoveries we love to explore on the cutting edge. It's a testament to the ingenuity and hard work of the researchers, and we're thrilled to have the opportunity to share their findings with our listeners.
Absolutely, Tom. This is the kind of work that can truly transform the way commercial banks approach credit risk management, empowering them to be more proactive, responsive, and effective in safeguarding their assets and ensuring financial stability. It's an exciting development, and we're eager to see how this research continues to evolve and make an impact in the years to come.
Well said, Jen. Thank you all for joining us on this journey of scientific exploration. We'll be back next time with another fascinating research paper that's pushing the boundaries of what's possible. Until then, stay curious and keep exploring the cutting edge.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
And now, let's take a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors, NanoBank, the future of credit risk management.
Are you a commercial bank struggling to keep up with the ever-changing tides of the financial market? Are your credit risk models as outdated as your grandparents' flip phones?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing NanoBank, the cutting-edge credit risk early warning system powered by nano-sized neural network chips.
That's right, folks. Our patented NanoBank technology is smaller than a grain of sand, yet it packs the computing power of a supercomputer. Just slip one of these bad boys into your server rack and watch as it scans the financial landscape for potential credit risks.
No more relying on clunky statistical models or outdated data. NanoBank's neural network is constantly learning, adapting, and forecasting the next big credit crisis before it even happens.
And the best part, NanoBank requires zero maintenance. These nano devices are programmed to self-update, self-optimize, and self-destruct any suspicious activity, all without human intervention.
So, what are you waiting for? Ditch your outdated credit risk management system and upgrade to NanoBank. The future of banking is here, and it's smaller than your pinky nail.
NanoBank, the credit risk early warning system that's nano in size but mega in power. Visit nanobank.com to learn more.
And we're back. Stay tuned. Folks, as we dive deeper into the cutting-edge world of commercial banking and credit risk management.